Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. By the time police discovered the first body buried beneath a barn on property Jeffrey and Alice Lundgren had rented, it was January of 1990. Jeffrey, Alice, and their followers were long gone, having moved away more than 6 months earlier. Kirtland, Ohio Police Chief Dennis Yarborough had no idea where the group had gone, though he suspected they were up to no good. But he had no proof of that. Not until New Year's Eve of 1989, when one of Jeffrey's longtime followers came forward with a horrific tale. We left off last episode, part one of this two-parter, with Jeffrey and his disciples planning a takeover of the RLDS temple in Kirtland. The plan was to kill some 25 supposedly wicked people living within a block radius of the temple, which was awful enough, but the grisliest part of the plot was reserved for the Reverend Dale Luffman, his wife, and two children. Jeffrey had a special plan for them. They'd be offered as sacrifices to God. The term was blood atonement. Jeffrey would cut the heads off each of them, the same way Nephi had cut off the head of Laban. Jeffrey and his followers practiced for this scenario for more than a year. Jeffrey told them he was certain of the day and month the attack should take place because God had provided that information in a vision. It was to occur on May 3rd, Jeffrey's birthday. But God had been less specific about the year. Jeffrey said he believed it would be 1988, the day Jeffrey would turn 38 years old, but he would consult with God in the days prior just to make sure. In the meantime, Jeffrey stockpiled weapons and warned his followers that they not only needed to physically prepare for the attack, but also spiritually. See, only the pure would be allowed to commune with Jesus Christ. The impure would burst into flames. Jeffrey implored them to repent their sins. He chastised them when they questioned his teachings. If someone made what he deemed a mistake during his nightly droning scripture classes, they had to endure what he called sessions, periods of beratement that could last until 3 or 4 in the morning. The supposed mistakes his followers would make, by the way, included simply asking questions about Jeffrey's interpretation of chiasmus, the secret way of interpreting passages in the Bible and the Book of Mormon that he claimed to have discovered, though in reality scholars had been discussing them for decades. Jeffrey had become obsessed with his interpretation of chiasmus, a literary device found throughout religious texts where ideas are presented in one order and then repeated in reverse. Think of it as an X pattern, like, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. It's a common structure in Hebrew poetry. Jeffrey Lundgren took this legitimate scholarly tool and twisted it into something far more sinister, using it to claim God was revealing secret messages that only Jeffrey could decipher. When followers questioned him, Jeffrey would launch into complex explanations about scriptural patterns that made his interpretation sound divinely inspired rather than delusional. As one follower said, quote, Anyone who believed in the pattern also came to believe in the seer who brought it forth. And since the pattern could not err, they came to believe that the seer could not err either, end quote. In other words, Jeffrey was infallible. And so, when he said the pattern revealed to him that God was ordering his followers to help him slay an entire family, nearly every one of them accepted that as God's command. As Yarborough dug through the mud to recover the family murdered by Jeffrey and his disciples, he saw nothing divine about it. The first body uncovered was an adult man. He hadn't been beheaded. Jeffrey had changed his mind about that, but rather shot while his hands were bound. Next, a woman's body was unearthed. She had not only been shot, but tape had been wound so tightly around her head, she looked like a mummy. One of the bodies had so badly decomposed that her left foot fell off. Yarborough would never forget that sight, a tiny foot falling from the frame of a 36-pound body. The girl had been shot through the top of the head at a downward angle by someone looming over her. The remains were not the Luffmans. Jeffrey had changed his mind about that, too. These remains belonged to a different family altogether, one who had pledged loyalty to the Lundgrens and had trusted Jeffrey would introduce them to Jesus. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. We put up Halloween decorations this week, like full haunted house mode, and by the time I sit down at night, my brain is still doing jump scares.
Which is when you reach for Cornbread Hemp CBD gummies.
Yep, they actually help me relax at the end of the day. Cornbread Hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD.
And everything's USDA organic and third-party lab tested, so you know what you're getting is clean.
Plus, the flavors are good. Watermelon, berry, peach, so it feels like a tiny treat, not a chore.
Right now, Crimes of the Centuries listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout.
That's cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC. You're surely wondering why, after months and months of planning and practicing and praying, Jeffrey Lundgren decided to spare the Luffmans. The short answer is, he didn't. God did. Remember, Jeffrey wasn't sure what year the temple takeover was meant to happen, and he told his followers, when he communed with God just before the May 3rd, 1988 attack, he was told it wasn't time. Jeffrey had reached his usual meeting spot on what he said was Ohio's tallest mountain, though it absolutely was not, and God had arrived with a beam of light that shone down through a clear blue sky, and God was angry. He was disappointed in Jeffrey's followers who were still impure, unclean. God told Jeffrey that his followers had more repenting to do. Quote, thus saith the Lord, this is not the year for Christ to return to his temple, end quote. With no Christ coming, there was no need to take over the temple and no need to kill the Luffmans. What Jeffrey didn't tell his followers was that the cops had been tipped off to the May 3rd plan and had scared the bejesus out of him just days earlier. Here's what really happened. One of Jeffrey's followers was a man named Kevin Curry, who had met Jeffrey during the Navy. Jeffrey had been Kevin's supervisor working in an electronics repair shop, which I didn't know was a thing Navy people did, but so it goes. The two men didn't have much in common. Jeffrey was ultra-religious and from Missouri. Kevin was a laid-back New Yorker with a tattoo that read, "Just passing through." He wasn't so concerned with the second coming or an afterlife or things like that. Author Pete Early, in his Prophet of Death book, describes Kevin one night going to a brothel, watching some women have sex together on a stage with a cucumber, then paying one of the women for sex and keeping the cucumber as a souvenir. He told Jeffrey about it, who wrote in great detail about the event to Alice. Kevin didn't like Jeffrey much at first because Jeffrey seemed like an arrogant, pompous know-it-all. But as the months at sea passed, he started to look up to the guy who was always reading scriptures. And Jeffrey wasn't like a lot of the other military men around. He didn't cuss or drink coffee or smoke or pay for sex with women in brothels, though he would soon force Alice into some far more deviant abusive acts. At this point in his marriage, however, he was writing love letters to Alice every day. And Kevin noticed. He also noticed that Jeffrey didn't evangelize, which actually got Kevin curious about Mormonism. When the men returned from Vietnam in June of 1974, they were stationed in San Diego, where Alice had already found an apartment and was waiting with Jeffrey's firstborn, Damon. She was also 9 months pregnant with the couple's second, who would be named Jason. Alice wasn't thrilled when Jeffrey invited Kevin of Cucumber Story fame to the apartment for dinner, but she grew to like him. He opened up about his difficult childhood. Here he is, talking to A&E.
I had not had a very solid childhood. This was probably the first time that I felt a part of a family experience.
As a child, he'd been shuttled among relatives and moved around a lot. He said he attended 14 different schools before high school graduation. And same, bud, my tally was 12 schools in 7 states. Soon, Kevin was reading the Book of Mormon and studying scripture with Jeffrey. The two would attend a local RLDS congregation where Kevin was brought up to speed on the official history of the church. Kevin was baptized in October 1974, soon after which Jeffrey was discharged. He, Alice, and their two sons moved back to Missouri. Kevin stayed behind, but not for good. When Kevin next saw the Lundgrens in Kirtland, Ohio, there were two more children in the family, Kristen and Caleb. Their reunion was a complete coincidence. Kevin just so happened to have traveled with a group of New Yorkers to visit the temple, and there Jeffrey was as the temple's tour guide. The sight of Jeffrey standing there in the temple doorway triggered a memory in Kevin. Soon after he had started studying the Book of Mormon, he'd had a vision of a door opening with a brilliant white light spilling through it. He told Jeffrey that night, quote, "The door that I saw in my mind 10 years ago was the door to the Kirtland Temple. It was the door that you opened tonight," end quote. In January 1985, Kevin moved to Kirtland. He turned over the $1,600 a month he earned at a VA hospital to Jeffrey and Alice and slept on their couch. He later said he was happy to do it. He was certain that God was speaking to him through Jeffrey. Jeffrey didn't think as fondly of Kevin, or any of his followers for that matter. Here's author Pete Early.
You know, he said to me during an interview once, he said, "The church is the easiest place to take over. All you have to do is know a few scriptures, and that impresses people, and you can slowly take power and control."
About Kevin specifically, Jeffrey told Early that he was nothing more than a leech. Quote, "A leech needs to be attached to a host. I became that host." In a way, Kevin wasn't that much different from all the others who eventually joined the group. They were all drawn to me because there was something lacking in their own personalities and lives. They wanted me to provide it for them. They were weak. I was strong. I was their host, end quote. Which is a really cruel way to put it, but it's not totally wrong. Jeffrey, after all, was a cult leader, and cult leaders feed off vulnerable people, people who feel unwanted, who have holes in their lives, who would allow for this type of treatment, as described by follower Shar Olson.
"We were a family. We were all living under Jeff's tent. Jeff was our father. Alice was our mother. Our own parents were not our parents. They did not love us. They were not going to take us to the face of Christ. We weren't going to be able to see and touch and feel Christ. Therefore, they were not our parents. Jeff and Alice were our parents."
Some of the people Jeffrey appealed to were loners without families, like Kevin Curry and some teenage church members who also joined the Klan. Others had families and yet were drawn to the cult nonetheless. Every member called Jeffrey Dad and Alice Mom. That included Dennis Avery and his wife Cheryl, who had 3 daughters, 15-year-old Trina, 13-year-old Becky, and 6-year-old Karen. They had first met Jeffrey in Independence, where the adults had taken his classes. Early wrote that Cheryl became such a believer, the class began to joke that Jeffrey was her personal guru. Here's how Early described the couple. Quote, "To most, Dennis and Cheryl seemed strange. Dennis was mousy. Cheryl was uncomfortable around strangers. Neither dressed fashionably or was good at small talk. Cheryl didn't participate in many high school activities after school. She didn't date, didn't give a hoot about being popular." End quote. Cheryl hadn't known her father either because her parents divorced when she was still an infant. She had never had a boyfriend before she happened to meet Dennis Avery, a slight, nerdy-looking man, in September 1969. They were married soon after. Their daughters came in 1974, 1976, and 1982. They considered the youngest, Karen, to be a miracle baby because doctors were sure Dennis couldn't father any more children after a bout of urinary and prostate problems. Cheryl and Dennis gelled with Jeffrey and Alice because they, too, were adamantly opposed to women priests. And I want to emphasize here that this seems to have been more of a bugaboo for Cheryl than even for Dennis. Internalized misogyny is definitely a thing. She thought their RLDS was being led completely astray by giving women standing in the church, which is a tad ironic because everyone outside of the Avery family saw Cheryl as the pants wearer of the household. So much so that Jeffrey didn't approve. He didn't see Cheryl submitting to her husband the way he thought was proper. Kevin Curry again.
Jeffrey and Alice would tell little stories about the Averys, and they were not very kind towards the Averys at all. They were a family of bookworms, and they were very, very passive kind of individuals.
The Averys thought much more highly of the Lundgrens. So highly, in fact, that they followed the family to Kirtland within days of them leaving Independence and stayed a weekend with them right after Jeffrey started his tour guide job. The Lundgrens had a miserable time with the Averys that weekend, but the Averys had such a good time that Cheryl wrote her mother, Donna, a letter detailing their amazing stay and praising Jeffrey Lundgren as something special. It wasn't until Jeffrey learned that Dennis had inherited money from his mother recently that the supposed prophet started being kind to the Averys. Dennis had used the money to pay off his mortgage and buy a secondhand car to ensure he was completely out of debt. Jeffrey found that a ludicrous use of the money and convinced the Averys to move to Kirtland in February 1987. They told their families that they had to go. Jeffrey had convinced them Zion was in Kirtland, and if they wanted to see Jesus, they had to move there. Dennis gave that secondhand car to Jeffrey, then quit his job and sold their house for $20,000, far less than market value, packed their few furnishings in a U-Haul, and drove away. Trina, Becky, and Karen soon began classes in the local school, and the Avery family lived in their own rental house, depositing their house sale proceeds into a bank account that Jeffrey soon had access to. More people came to Kirtland. Dennis and Tanya Patrick, Greg Winship, Ron and Susie Luff. Also in the crew were Sharon Blunchley and Daniel Kraft Jr., as well as Char Olson, Richard Brandt, and Deborah Olivares. When Jeffrey told the group about the temple takeover plan, they knew he was dead serious. How could they doubt it, considering the arsenal he was building?
The day that we moved out to the farm, I walked into the dining room, and from one end to the other were shotguns, bandoleros full of bullets, a few handguns, some knives, and it wasn't even all of the weapons I found out later that they had.
Jeffrey would eventually stockpile more than 4,000 rounds of ammunition, as well as a 48-pound handmade 50-caliber rifle that cost nearly $3,000. You might be wondering what possible purpose such a weapon could have. Well, it could shoot down a helicopter. Tensions were not waning with the Reverend Dale Luffman either. If you remember from last episode, the two butted heads over doctrine. Luffman said he told Jeffrey,
"It is not appropriate to the Christian gospel to dwell on the wrath without understanding mercy."
But Jeffrey was really into the wrath, and it became clear to Luffman that
there were people who were buying his recipe, and I was very concerned about how that recipe was getting played out.
He had no idea the play was meant to include his and his family's beheadings. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Butcher Box. When the Halloween decorations go up, that's the signal that the holiday season is basically tomorrow, and I just realized I'm hosting 15 people for Thanksgiving. 15.
That's not dinner. That's a catering operation.
Exactly why I'm relieved we've got ButcherBox. They deliver better meat and seafood straight to your door. 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised, crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
And everything comes from partners who meet strict animal welfare and sustainability standards. No antibiotics or added hormones ever.
I love that I can customize the box or let ButcherBox curate it for me, so I'm not fighting over the last turkey breast at the grocery store the day before Thanksgiving.
Plus, as a certified B Corp, ButcherBox holds itself to high standards, from how the animals are raised to how their team supports workers and reduces environmental impact.
Every box ships free, and you get perks like recipes, tips, and exclusive deals to make the most of every meal.
Right now, ButcherBox is offering our listeners $20 off their first box and free protein for a year.
Go to ButcherBox.com/COTC to get this limited time offer and free shipping always.
That's ButcherBox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Kevin Curry, the old Navy buddy of Jeffrey Lundgren's, wasn't keen on the temple takeover plan. It was one thing to set up shop there and await Jesus. It was another altogether to plan on killing dozens of people, particularly the Luffmans, who seemed like friendly enough folk. Char Olson wasn't into the plan either. Both of them fled the farm where the cult had moved after Bill and Eleanor Lord finally noticed that Jeffrey had been skimming from the tour donations and gift shop. Not lightly skimming either. Because much of it was pocketed without documentation, we can't know the total for sure, but based on previous year's revenue, church officials estimate he'd stolen somewhere between $25,000 and $40,000. That money should have funded church projects, like restoration work on the historic building. Instead, Jeffrey's followers would later tell investigators, it seemed to fund a comparatively lavish life for Jeffrey, Alice, and their kids. While the others were essentially fed rations and told there was no spare money for simple outings like trips to the movie theater, Jeffrey and Alice would often take their meals alone in their bedroom. Their kids always seemed to have new clothes, whereas the members' children did without. That didn't change when the group moved to the new locale, the farmhouse. Why the farm's owner agreed to rent to the Lundgrens is kind of a mystery. If he had checked with any of their past landlords, they would know the couple left each place they lived an absolute wreck. I mean, one landlord told Arthur Early that the Lundgrens lived in his place for a year, but only paid 2 months' rent. Not only that, but the guy said that Jeffrey had intentionally sawed open the sewer pipe in the basement, leaving a pile of human excrement that measured 1 foot deep and 6 feet in diameter. Again, Jeffrey and his poop. I keep a pretty open mind, but I feel confident that if God were to choose a prophet, it wouldn't be one so fascinated with feces. Anyway, Kevin wanted nothing to do with the Luffman murders. He was so unnerved by Jeffrey's plan that he left everything behind in Kirtland, returned to his New York roots, and instructed everyone who knew him to keep his whereabouts a secret.
It was obvious that Jeffrey had gone over the line. I was just not willing to take the lives of any innocent individual.
Kevin left in February 1988. 2 months later, just a few weeks before the temple plan was to take place, He called the Kirtland police to warn them that something foul was afoot. Trouble was, nothing had happened yet. Kevin's warning was preemptive. Police didn't have probable cause for a search warrant. Still, Chief Yarborough took the warning seriously enough that he figured he should do something. So he called Lundgren in for a chat and told him that neighbors had called in with concerns about people in military gear on Jeff's property. In short, he warned him, "We're watching you. We think you're up to something." It was enough to thwart the takeover and spare the Luffman's lives. But it didn't satiate Jeffrey's growing bloodlust. It only changed his target. The morning Jeffrey announced that God didn't want him to attack the temple after all, Char Olson decided he was a fraud. She had woken up early that day and had watched as Jeffrey went to the hill that he called Ohio's tallest mountain, and when he came home with his tale of a bright stream of sunlight coming through crystal blue sky, she knew he was full of it. It had been cloudy on that hill. She'd seen it with her own eyes. She wasn't afraid as Kevin had been, so she didn't leave in the dead of night. She just moved back across town and kept her job as a waitress at one of the diners. And she still cared for some of her friends in the group and didn't go to the police because she didn't think Jeffrey was an actual threat anymore. He was all talk, no action. She did, however, tell Luffman about the plan, though not until that fall. Things had been coming to a head. Some of the cult followers' family members had started reaching out to police, to Luffman, to Char, all looking to find out why they hadn't heard back from their loved ones in so long. Luffman told Char, "Look, I need to get this guy kicked out of the church. Do you have anything you can tell me that would help?" Char said, "Well, promise not to tell anyone, but he was planning on killing you and your whole family." Luffman broke his promise, told the cops, and took steps to get Jeffrey excommunicated from the church on the basis of the temple skimming and teaching doctrines contrary to the church's beliefs. He also tossed in a charge of encouraging members to quit the church for good measure. But Luffman kept mum on the plot to slaughter his family and take over the Kirtland Temple at Yarborough's request. The police chief didn't want to let Jeffrey know how much law enforcement knew. Investigators circled back to Char, who told police everything she knew. She had even kept detailed notes in a spiral notebook about bullet types, gas mask instructions, military terms, you name it. She had instructions in there on how to dismantle an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. So police were gathering clues, but none of it was quite enough. It wasn't illegal, after all, to own weapons and tell other people how to use them. Sure, it was a problem. He had been planning to kill the Luffmans and attack the temple, but that plan had been in May. It was now September. And by both Kevin and Char's accounts, the plan appeared scrapped. Yarborough felt he needed more, so he sat tight. He had no idea that Jeffrey had already picked a new target and that it was one within his flock. In spring of 1989, the cult got two new members. Keith Johnson was an old college buddy of the Lundgrens. In fact, he had actually introduced Alice to Jeffrey all those years before. Keith came to the compound with his wife, Catherine, who went by Kathy. Jeffrey had worked for months to convince Keith to come, and it was clear when Keith arrived that he and Kathy were already believers. Jeffrey brought them up to speed. He was a prophet. He got messages directly from God, and God's latest message was that Jeffrey should lead his followers into the wilderness, where Jesus would appear to them, assuming they had repented enough to not get swallowed by flames in his presence. Oh, and God had also told him one more thing. From Pete Early.
Jeffrey announces that he has been told to eliminate the most sinful members of the group. And in his view, the most sinful members of the group are the Avery family.
Exactly why Jeffrey and Alice were so hostile to the Averys is unclear. Jeffrey didn't like that Dennis was passive and Cheryl more the pants wearer. But it isn't as though Cheryl was super in your face either. And there's an anecdote in Early's book describing how Cheryl called someone to ask how to clean up spilled orange juice. The call taker suggested something that was a total no-duh, a store-bought cleaner. The actual agent wasn't specified, but I'm guessing something like Dawn or vinegar or something. Cheryl was like, phew, thanks. The kid spilled this 4 days ago, and I just couldn't figure this thing out. So yeah, she wasn't exactly a vocal feminist type. Plus, she agreed with Jeffrey on all of his conservative church leanings. It was one of the reasons his teachings resonated so much with her and the rest of her family. So I don't know the why behind the one-sided animosity, but I know what happened as a result of it. A mass murder that would haunt Chief Yarborough for the rest of his life. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. Between teaching, writing, podcasting, and now adopting a new baby bird, a biggin, the type who's going to be with us until we die, I've had a lot on my plate lately.
I can confirm that to-do list is very terrifying.
Yep, and when life starts to pile up like that, therapy can be a huge help. But finding a therapist who actually takes your insurance, that's where it gets tricky.
Enter Rula. They make it easy to find affordable, quality mental health care that's covered by insurance.
Exactly. Rula partners with over 100 insurance plans, and the average copay is just $15 per session, sometimes even zero, depending on your benefits.
And they don't just toss you the first available therapist. Rula matches you with licensed professionals based on your goals, preferences, and background, so you actually find someone who fits.
You can even get an appointment as soon as tomorrow. No wait lists, no runaround, just real help when you need it.
Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit Rula.com/COTC to get started.
After you sign up, you'll be asked how you heard about them. Please support our show and let them know we sent you. That's RULA.com/COTC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. After God spared the Luffman family, Jeffrey Lundgren announced to his followers he'd received a new message from on high. The group was to live in the wilderness. But first, they had to kill the entire Avery family. And possibly some of the other members too, but that was TBD. His initial plan again involved beheading because it seemed more biblical, I guess. But God clarified that a gun would do just as well. Preparations began on April 10, 1989, when Jeffrey ordered two of his followers to dig a pit in the ground beneath the barn behind the farmhouse. It was to be 6 feet by 7 feet and 4 feet deep. He figured that would be plenty big for five bodies. The ditch diggers were Ron Luff and Daniel Kraft, who had been living alongside Jeffrey for months. Isolated from outside influences and cut off from their families, other than Luff's wife, Susie, who was also in the cult. It took them much of the week to do the digging unnoticed, stealing away when the Averys weren't around. Meanwhile, Jeffrey had the women in the group start packing their belongings for the wilderness trip. Even the Averys packed, though they were the only ones who didn't know that they would not be joining the others on the adventure. Jeffrey had all the members write letters to their closest family members, explaining that they would be away for some time. He figured that would delay the filings of missing persons reports. When Jeffrey asked for Cheryl Avery's letter, she hadn't written one yet. He was insistent on hers especially, so she wrote a letter to her mother saying that Dennis had gotten a job in Wyoming and they needed to move there quickly. This letter would be their last communication with the outside world. On April 17th, Jeffrey and some of the men moved all of the Avery's possessions to his farmhouse, their furniture, their clothes, everything they owned. He told them they were consolidating everyone's belongings for the trip. He even rented them a room at a nearby motel supposedly so they could have privacy before the big departure. To the Averys, the Lundgrens seemed to be taking care of them, leading them to salvation. Six-year-old Karen even drew a picture for Alice, her second mom. That night, when the Averys came to the farmhouse under the guise of dining before their morning departure, Karen ran up to Alice and hugged her and said she was upset that she had forgotten the picture at the motel. "That's okay, honey," Alice told her. "We'll get it later." Alice would later testify that she had no idea Jeffrey was really planning to kill the Averys. She'd heard him say he would, but she added,
"I went to him and I said, 'Are you really saying that you're going to kill people?' And he said, 'No, no, no, this is just a test of faith. I'm not going to do anything. Don't worry about it.'"
Yet every other member of the cult would later say that Alice not only knew, but she facilitated. Anyhow, the family-style dinner was meant to be a last supper for the Averys. Some of the members were too upset to eat, but somehow, the Averys never got suspicious. Debbie Olivares had cooked, at Jeffrey's direction, roast beef, mashed potatoes with gravy, corn, and a salad with bread. At one point, as they ate, Dennis noticed Karen had skipped the corn, so he told her to eat some. Her refusal steeled Jeffrey's resolve, serving as proof that the six-year-old was, as he would later tell author Early, a, quote, "rebellious and wicked child," end quote. After dinner, Alice took her kids away from the farm. Jeffrey headed back to the barn. Dennis Avery was the first to be summoned. Ronloff told him that Jeffrey wanted him to come show which belongings of his and Cheryl's they wanted to take into the wilderness. Ron had a 50,000-volt stun gun hidden in his pocket. Why he chose to use it as Dennis walked willingly toward the barn is a mystery, but he did. And instead of it knocking Dennis out cold like Ron had envisioned, it just pissed Dennis off. "What are you doing?" he screamed as he was zapped. Another zap. "God damn it, this isn't necessary." Yet, he kept walking toward the barn. I think this speaks volumes to the treatment Jeffrey Lundgren had unleashed on his followers. Even being zapped with a stun gun wasn't red flaggy enough to give them pause. Inside the barn, followers Greg, Richard, Danny, and Damon, that last one is the Lundgren's eldest child, remember, duct taped Dennis's hands, feet, and mouth. They carried him into the barn's back room and lowered him into the muddy pit they'd spent days digging for his and his family's corpses. Jeffrey later said that Dennis's eyes were intentionally not covered because he wanted him to know, quote, "who was sending him before God for his wickedness," end quote. Outside the barn, Greg revved a chainsaw to mask the sounds of gunfire. After two shots pierced Dennis's heart, Jeffrey ordered his followers to look at the body. Damon began to cry. He later said, quote, "I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like that before. It was my own father that had just did that," end quote. Asked to fish the motel room key from Dennis's pocket, Damon balked. He said he couldn't do it. He couldn't believe Dennis was dead. The reality of what was happening came crashing down around him. Cheryl was summoned next. Her husband needed her help, Ron told her. Once in the barn, she shook with confusion as the men wrapped tape around her hands, ankles, mouth, and this time eyes. Greg revved the chainsaw as Jeffrey fired into her torso, a different type of bullet than he'd shot into Dennis. See, he figured these five murders would be a good learning experience when it came to the arsenal he had stockpiled, so Dennis was shot with soft-pointed hollow points while Cheryl got full metal jacketed rounds. Jeffrey later told Early, quote, "According to the scriptures, I was going to kill again. I wanted to learn as much as I could from this experience," end quote. The girls came next. One by one, they were individually taken to the barn. Trina, the 15-year-old, turned her head slightly just as Jeffrey pulled the trigger aimed for her skull. She screamed, "Ouch!" So he fired twice more into her back. The younger two girls were promised the chance to see horses in the barn, but that they had to take turns. Becky was the feistiest of the girls and tried to fight. When she took her last breath, her hands were outstretched in the direction of her dead mother, as though reaching out to her. Ron Luff carried 6-year-old Karen to the barn on his back like a big brother piggyback ride. When she was delivered, bound, to the pit, Jeffrey lorded over her and fired a 225 grain hollow point slug into the top of her skull. Jeffrey, an idiot as well as a monster, told the men to dump bags of lime onto the Avery's bodies, claiming it would help them decompose faster. Spoiler alert, that's a myth. Quicklime does not speed decomposition. In fact, it helps preserve bodies by creating an alkaline environment that can essentially mummify remains. But that element of his idiocy wouldn't be the one to cause his downfall.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
The morning after Jeffrey Lundgren and his followers executed the 5 members of the Avery family, Police Chief Dennis Yarborough came knocking. Literally, he came to the door of the farmhouse. He'd long been in contact about Lundgren with FBI Special Agent Robert Alvord. The two lawmen were certain the cult was up to no good, but they hadn't been able to dig up anything concrete to do much about it. After Shar Olson and Kevin Curry had called in tips, they'd managed to convince the feds to investigate Lundgren as a possible domestic terrorist, which gave them room to wiretap some of Shar's phone calls with members of the group she was still friendly with. But the members were smart enough not to say much on the phone. Jeffrey was, rightly, paranoid that their calls were being monitored. They asked their superiors about getting a search warrant for Jeffrey's farm, but were denied. Undeterred, they arrived to the farm without a warrant, but with a mighty show of force. Some 16 members of the FBI and all 6 officers from the Kirtland Police Force would arrive together and basically just hope that Jeffrey would assume they had a search warrant and not ask to see it. And it worked. Officers were allowed to walk the property and look inside the farmhouse, but no one had ever even heard of the Averys except in passing as a family that maybe, possibly, could be among Jeffrey's followers. They didn't know there had been talk of killing them. They didn't know that something sinister had happened in the barn not 12 hours earlier. When they went into the barn, they saw the back room strewn with garbage and dirt, but there was nothing that screamed makeshift graveyard to prompt them to dig. They left. Soon after, so did Jeffrey and his followers. They hightailed it for the quote-unquote wilderness, setting up camp in a state park in West Virginia. Jeffrey's hubris only grew. He had tasted blood, as it were, and felt more powerful than ever. He routinely dressed down his remaining followers, warning Dennis Patrick and Richard Brand that he'd almost killed them too that night. But lucky for them, their wives had been obedient to Alice, and that saved their hides. The Avery's deaths were traumatic for everyone. Those who participated certainly don't deserve sympathy, but they all had trouble grappling with what they had done. It was one thing to read about violence in the Bible and imagine carrying something similar out in real life. It was another to lead someone to their doom, tie them up, reassure them when they panicked, to watch bullets tear through their flesh and rip open their skulls. I don't like getting graphic with all of this, But I think it's important to understand what Jeffrey's followers were seeing every time they closed their eyes. None would later say that they had truly felt like they'd done the right thing. In fact, Tanya Patrick said, quote, "I kept thinking about Karen. The last time I'd seen her, Jeffrey had been holding her on his lap. He had been playing with her. And now he had just killed her," end quote. At the same time, Jeffrey was loosey-goosey with threatening to kill the others when they displeased him. They could wrap their heads around Jeffrey announcing that the Averys, the most fringe members of the cult, who lived apart and were rarely invited to group outings, were evil, but they felt like they knew the others weren't. And these were people who had quit their jobs and cashed out their retirements and handed over all their earthly possessions to Jeffrey. They not only believed in him, but at this point, they had participated in murder for him. Oh, and remember, the whole point of those murders was to see Jesus Christ, who didn't seem to be showing up in West Virginia. Author Pete Early.
They felt deceived. They felt betrayed. They felt humiliated. Most of all, they felt terrified. If Jeffrey was a fraud, if what he taught wasn't real, they had helped murder five innocent people, including three children. And they had to live with that.
That was already starting to splinter the group. Then Jeffrey took a liking to Tanya Patrick, as in Dennis Patrick's wife. He pored through scripture and, wouldn't you know it, he found something that he said proved God approved of polygamy. So he took Tanya as his second wife. Neither Dennis nor Alice was too happy with this arrangement. To their relief, Jeffrey soon lost interest after he and Tanya had sex. Then Jeffrey got another message from God. It turns out that God hadn't shown up yet because he was displeased with the men in the group, and he ordered Jeffrey to kill every one of them, unless their women stepped in to save them. See, this was called intercession. Jeffrey said that back in the days of Moses, when a man displeased his lord and master, the wife could intercede, that is, beg the Lord to spare her husband and family. So you might be thinking, oh, I get it. Jeffrey wanted all the women in his group to beg him to spare their husbands? No, that would be too easy. He wanted the women to choreograph, rehearse, and perform separate hour-long strip teases before him, during each of which he would masturbate, discreetly beneath the sheet, of course, because what was he, a pervert? And if he successfully climaxed, he would spare the women's partners. These performances spanned a few days. None of the men were killed, but they did start to feel pretty emasculated and bitter. One wife's striptease had particularly pleased Jeffrey, and over his wife Alice's quite vocal objections, he took Kathy Johnson as his second wife. Never mind that she was married to Keith Johnson, and let's just pretend that whole Tanya Patrick thing never happened. Jeffrey sure did. The group lived months like this, but it was not a pleasant existence. Not only were they living out a ridiculous soap opera, but they were living it out in utter terror that Jeffrey might, at any point, put a bullet in someone else's brain. Plus, winter was coming, and it was going to be hella cold in the wilderness. In December, Jeffrey took Alice back to her parents' house, where he pretended he wasn't continuing to sleep with Kathy, but he was. Keith Johnson, meanwhile, was crushed by his wife willingly becoming Jeffrey's second wife. She not only left Keith, but also their children, to live as a mistress stashed away in a dilapidated motel room. Keith decided he wasn't feeling super loyal to Jeffrey anymore. He walked into a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms office in Kansas City, Missouri, and told them everything. He drew a map of Jeffrey's barn, showing exactly where the bodies were buried.
There is some confusion over the exact number of bodies that have been found in a common grave in the basement of this barn along Route 6. Police, firemen, and federal alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents spent the entire day sifting through the grave. The body of a man was found last night, two or three others this afternoon, and the search goes on at this hour.
That was a broadcast from News 5 Cleveland. It was everybody's worst nightmare. Chief Yarborough and Agent Alvord would forever wonder if they should have pushed harder in their investigation, though they knew intellectually that they'd done as much as they legally could at the time. When Yarborough, still Kirtland's police chief, died of a heart attack during a jog in 1998 at age 53, colleagues would say the stress of the case had contributed. The Reverend Dale Luffman would forever know how close he and his own family came to death and would second-guess his own actions as well. Could he have done more to reach Jeffrey's followers? He'd barely crossed paths with the Averys. Maybe if he'd tried harder. Jeffrey, Damon, and Alice Lundgren were quickly arrested. The rest of the cult members were also located. Some were promised leniency if they testified against Jeffrey. A total of 13 people ultimately faced charges. The trials, there were three of them, were all spectacles. Given the opportunity to speak, Jeffrey said,
"I am a prophet of God. I'm even more than a prophet. I am not a false prophet, therefore I am not worthy of the penalty sought by those who seek my death. And it is understandable to me that the legal system has problems with me, a prophet."
That speech lasted 5 hours. Here's how it all panned out. Jeffrey and Alice Lundgren divorced, and Alice testified against her husband of nearly 20 years. Jeffrey married Kathy Johnson, who had become pregnant with his child by the time of the arrest. Kathy didn't face serious charges because she wasn't at the farmhouse when the Averys were killed. Neither did Tanya Patrick, Jeffrey's forsaken temporary wife, or her then-husband Dennis Patrick. Keith Johnson was spared because he tipped off police in the first place and also hadn't been at the farm during the murders. Lighter sentences were given to Richard Brand and Greg Winship as part of plea deals. Susan Luff, Sharon Blunchley, and Debbie Olivares, each of whom played a role in distracting the Averys before they were marched to their deaths, were sentenced to 7 to 25 years in prison apiece. They were eligible for parole in the late 1990s and are no longer imprisoned. But Daniel Kraft Jr. and Ron Luff both are. Those men are the ones who dug the graves and took part in the actual gagging and binding of the victims. Ron Luff is the one who gave little Karen the piggyback ride. Later, he would say without emotion of her slaying,
"And all I saw was the top of the little girl's head when he shot."
Both he and Kraft were sentenced to up to life in prison on kidnapping and aggravated murder convictions. Kraft has the earliest possible parole date of 2034. As for the Lundgrens, Alice remains in prison. She's eligible for parole in 2091. Her oldest son, Damon, skirted the death penalty for what he'd done at age 19. About to turn 55 years old, he isn't eligible for parole until 2098. The couple's three younger children were taken in by Alice's parents. Their father, Jeffrey Lundgren, still appears on the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction website. Under institution status, it states, released-death. He was killed by lethal injection on October 24, 2006. With his last words, he professed his love for God, his family, and his wife, Kathy. He said, quote, "I am because you are," end quote. And then he was no more. To research this case, I read Pete Early's 1991 book, Prophet of Death, The Mormon Blood Atonement Killings and Contemporary News Reports. Early's book was written before Lundgren's execution in 2006, so I supplemented with contemporary news reports and retrospectives to round out my research. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.